Testing 1, 2, 3.
Meantime, I don't believe that I could say that it didn't have its effect on their efforts. I can't criticize them. You know what I'm saying? Is that could look, it's great. It's fine. This is fine for them. But as I said earlier, I didn't feel that we should do it. That was my feeling. And I'm glad I'm glad we didn't do it. I believe there was a great deal more acceptance on the part of the union members who could understand that what we did was not forcing them to do something that we didn't want by way of law, but by way of their own organization, within their own organization. And I think it made a better atmosphere is what I really think.
I just wonder if finally you could comment on the what you feel about the efforts of the UAW in the same industry in trying to gain job rights for blacks there, and compare their attitude, not their attitude, but just generally the work they did to your own work in the
to compare the UAW and the machinists, it certainly is like comparing apples and mothballs. One, you have to understand, as I said earlier, that the only reason that the AFL union changed was because of a threat of the CIO, and that they were an industrial union representing everybody from the back door to the front door, coming under the same union. And even in the skill groups of the machinists, or rather in the AFL, and the machinists being a part of that, could understand that their own destruction would be if they did not do likewise. Now, the thing was, they weren't ready for blacks, but they recognized that they had to be an industrial union. Now, in the UAW, the UAW came on with everything they did with a look of sincerity, and it was sincere. They were the first union to set up a civil rights department within their own structure. And I know that E.J. Franklin, who was the guy that I knew, was on that international staff as, I think, the FEP officer, and worked with him in the community. I well recall when we did a number of things within the NAACP in reference to jobs and things like this. What happened here was a visual difference that people could see. And certainly the UAW recognized that, look, if we're going to be doing these kind of things and we're organizing, as far as blacks are concerned, they didn't have to sell the blacks. First place, you have to understand something. I think for the most part, blacks need less selling to trade unionism than any ethnic group. And I say that, and the reason I say it is because, one, they can understand without somebody with strength, they cannot achieve. Okay? They got to have somebody in numbers. They can recognize that. And I don't think it takes any kind of real explanation as a reason why you should be a trade unionist, the guys. That being true, wherever blacks were, and UAW was concerned, they went in and they were one of the first, of course. The UAW structure, when its inception, I think, came from the efforts of the blacks. And if I'm not incorrect, during the automobile thing, sit-ins, and this kind of thing, there are large numbers of blacks who come from the South and went to Michigan, Detroit, these areas, working in these automobile plants. And they knew that unless they were able to get the blacks into this, that they weren't going to have the success within the UAW unless they did. And recognizing this, they, from the very beginning, they had done this kind of thing. And the machinists, it was altogether different. And you see, the thing is that you have to understand, in the skilled trades, and I can understand, these jobs are jealously guarded. They are jealously guarded. A great deal of pride and all of these things go into it. It takes 4 years to become a journeyman out of the skill groups. And you had a number of people within the skill groups who wanted their children, their sons, and this kind of thing to move into these jobs, look at jobs, and prepare them for this. So they figured that blacks were a threat to this kind of thing. That was one. Then, of course, you had to get the other guy who just was a race baiter. He's a bigot. He just hated blacks. And, of course, if he was in there, it didn't necessarily mean because it was because he was protecting the job. He was protecting the job against the blacks because he liked blacks. So this is the kind of difference that you had to face between the two. And I would say that this had as much to do with the change in the picture as far as machinists are concerned relative to bringing in blacks as the efforts that we put into it. I think what we did, what we really tried to do, was to highlight these things they already knew. They knew this. But there had to be somebody on the outside saying, look, this is me. And if you're going to be doing these things to me, this is the way it's going to affect your organization. Now, they knew that. But then we had to say it. We had to do it. We had to show it. And that's what we tried to do. And I think that the same thing applies even now. If you do not show that you are against something, they'll go on pleasantly feeling that it's accepted. And you see, I don't feel, and maybe I'm getting a little bit more tolerant as I get older, and maybe I try to be too conciliatory in trying to change things. I try to give the guy the other side of it in recognition. I'm not satisfied with my own organization, right? I mean, I got a lot of things that I believe that we should be doing. I speak out. I speak out when I believe it's going to do some good. I don't get out in the street and speak out. I speak out where it can be heard, and they know that I will do this. We don't have a single black in a policy-making position. When I say that, I'm talking my own union now, where a vice president, for instance, and we got eight of them, and we don't have one. We don't have a woman. And now, here we are at organizing, and sure, we got. I think one of the finest, in my opinion, since I've been a machinist, I believe that we have one of the most aggressive, one of the most militant leaders that we've ever had in Wimpy. I believe that. But I disagree with him in some areas, and I think he can understand that. He should be able to understand that. And of course, I have told him so. And I believe in time it will be corrected. But unless we speak out for these corrections, I think it's easy to put them on the back burner. And I would hope that we're going to make some corrections. I know that they've got to be done. I find it pretty difficult to say that we have a law that we are supposed to enforce as far as our employees are concerned in the shops on affirmative action. Aggressively, we are supposed to do that. And we tell management, look, if you don't have them, train them. Okay? And we're supposed to do that. But at the same time,
how?
If I'm in a shop, I know how the blacks feel. I am black. I'm with blacks. They talk to me. I know how they feel.
How can I feel my union is doing this kind of thing to them when we're not doing it ourselves?
It gives us little faith in our organization. And this is the thing that bothers me. I love my organization. If I didn't, I wouldn't have been in this long, because heaven knows I could have been out of this a long time ago. But this is my life, you know, and I like it. I like doing it, like working with people. I like the people I work with. And at least I feel I'm free to say what I want to say. And I try to do it in good taste. I try to be tactful. I try to do it where I think it's going to constructively build us. But this is one area that I'm very touchy on. See, time is long since gone when you can say that you've got a big organization, and I see no minority up there. And here we are there fighting like the Dickens. We got plenty of many women and it blacks. But this is, I guess, something that will come. It's like a come. Yeah. Yeah.
How did the IAM start bringing you in? They brought you into the leadership at a certain level after the color clause was dropped. Isn't that true? Or
well, they didn't bring me. Well, what happened was our organization is one where we boast of democracy. Okay, and I was elected to various things in the shop. I was a steward for about 12 years or more. I was elected a delegate to conventions, conferences. I was a district trustee, elected, and later, of course, elected as a full-time business representative. I tried to build on what knowledge I had acquired coming through the ranks by going to school, and I did get a certificate in industrial relations from UCLA. And with this as a background, of course, I would say that it did a lot in the way of moving me on into positions to be elected to these various things. And after becoming a business representative, I was later brought on to, now they requested me to come on to the international staff as an international officer.
Is that
a representative?
Yeah, I was wondering, that would have been something that was unusual for them to do in regards to black members up until that point. Was it not? Or?
Well, yes, it was unusual at the time that I was made an international rep, or what is called a Grand Lodge representative. First, you become a special rep. There was one other black in the East, Ed Webb. He was already and had been, I understand, a special rep for some time. And, of course, I was the second one. I guess it had to be at least years after it had been on the staff, I know, at least 3 years before I came on. And, well, at the time I came on, I explained that to the young lady that was talking to me before.
Mm-hmm.
I had several job offers to lead the machinists. And I brought this up with my vice president at that time, and he told me, "Herb, we don't want to see you leave. And let me see what I can do," because he had told me before that they wanted me on the staff. And he immediately, while I was sitting there, called our international president and talked with him and told him that I was going to leave. And apparently, judging from his conversation, Roy C. Miller, who was the president at that time, told him that I was assured of a job. And with April the 15th, the all resume, at that time, I guess it must have been about April the 5th or 6th, I was talking to him. And I said, sure. And sure enough, April the 15th, I was on the staff. And I've been on the staff since that time.
Okay. So then it was more that, would you say that it was the fact that you established your support from your co-workers, that you had won that recognition, that won you your position on the staff, and this was something?
Well, if I would make an appraisal, I would say that I had gained the respect of my fellow workers, and I believe they felt I was sincere in what I was doing. And after having achieved the positions as, a business representative, which is about as high, which is as high as you can get in the district, other than becoming the district president, of course, that the international recognized that I could be an asset. And surely I do want to be an asset to my international. And with that recognition, they asked me, they made it possible that I would be a part of the international staff.
And how do you, was this a period of transition as far as the national feelings on this issue? Was there some residual feelings that there was a problem with black being the leadership?
I don't recognize it as such. I'm sure they were aware. I'm sure they were aware that they were lax in having blacks in such positions. I'm sure they were. I don't think they're making a special effort. I really don't. I think that when it's brought to that tension that I was going to leave and that I could be an asset to the organization, that then they were ready to do something. Okay? Now, certainly, I think shortly after I came on, well, it wasn't too short because I think it was about 4 years after I was on the staff, Ed Webb and I were the only two blacks. And we took it up with the then president, who was Red Smith, that, look, you have two blacks, and we are spread it all over the United States, because I was being used a lot of places, okay? And it's not that we're opposed to work. It just doesn't look good. We believe there should be more blacks, and at the same time, we had made a request that they would have at least one black on the staff of each of our vice presidents, regional vice presidents. And Red assured us that this would happen. In fact, we possibly would have more than one as the need required. Well, at that time, he did start gradually putting them on. We had five blacks on the staff. And I guess the bottom fell out of everything. Aircraft went haywire and all this, if you recall, is quite a thing. Engineers out of jobs, stuff like this. So that curtailed that move, and that they couldn't put on anymore. And of course now, I think that we don't have no more than five now. And I'm just trying to think how many we do have blacks on the black staff. We've got two in my region now. Barnes and myself, and I think we have three Mexican Americans, one Indian, and these are minorities. We have now a woman, black woman, who is on the international staff. This is Ed Smith. I think we have about five or six blacks on staff now.
I almost forgot to ask you about what role the women played in the Yay Vote Committee. Was there much they were just coming in at that time, right?
Yeah, they were just coming in, but what happened was that number swelled, okay? And sure, they played a part. In fact, we tried to make them very visible because, see, we gave little parties and things like this. And you can't take it away from a woman. She can sell tickets, okay? And for that reason, of course, one of the reasons, we wanted to make them visible. We wanted to make them a part of the organization. And they did. They did a lot of work in, you know, the movement. Now, you know, the thing was that most of these women were married. And while you couldn't get them out to every meeting, you could get them out for special things. And we really tried to bring them in and put them in places where they'd be responsible. But then they were obligated to the home and the children and this kind of thing. And you see, these women were working and they didn't have too much time for home. And of course, husbands don't like this kind of thing. So that's the only reason they weren't as active as they might have been. Because there were some places that I had wanted, and we did really want to see women working with us, you know. But it's just a thing they couldn't do. But especially the men out there.
And how many of the black women, or blacks in general, were retained after the war when the labor shortage, quote, was over and when there was a bit of a recession in the economy?
A large number. A large number. I don't think, and to be fair with the question, that blacks were truly unfair and lucky, unfairly discriminated against in layoffs. Well, you had some layoffs where people were, but that's part of the grievance procedure to act on. Now, what I'm saying is that I don't know of any real effort to get rid of blacks now and keep whites. I don't know of that. I know that there might have been some isolated instances where a charge might have been made of discrimination. But, again, I don't know of any special effort.
So, would you say that most of the gains that were won during the war were retained?
Mm-hmm.
And was that true of other places in the industry?
What do you mean?
North Americans?
I really can't say, because the reason I say that is because I know that there were some charges brought by North American blacks that all kinds of charges that they weren't promoting, a number of things that they had brought up later, you know. But now, I wasn't close enough to make any judgment on that. And again, these are things that were brought out that I'd heard, or made in committees, NAACP committee, and this kind of thing. And I wasn't on the committee to investigate.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Okay.